This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarterbin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select sort of at random. Any book from my entire collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this lucky 13th episode of The Quarterbin, I'm looking at Cage number 1 for Marvel Comics, cover dated April 1992. Cage number 1 had a cover price of $1.50, meaning I acquired this comic at a pleasant enough 83% discount. The story, The Drowning Man, was written by Mark McLaurin, who I don't believe I've ever heard of. The art was by Dwayne Turner and Christopher Ivey, whose names don't exactly ring a lot of bells either. But that's not a bad sign, right? The cover is pretty standard stuff, with Cage front and center, breaking some chains that seem to have weird lightning energy coming off them. And this is a reference to action from the issue. Around him, in the background, in a black and white type of tone, are some scenes from the issue, and to avoid spoilers, I won't say what some of these scenes are. The issue itself starts with a quick narrative of Luke Cage's life, including his volunteering for a super serum experiment that allowed him early parole from imprisonment for a crime he did not commit. For all intents and purposes, the man he was died that day. But from the ashes, Luke Cage was born. We learn that the narrator is Dakota North, and this is actually part of a boardroom presentation on Cage's life, taking place at a newspaper office in Chicago. She continues, bringing us totally up to date, explaining that his Heroes for Hire gig with Iron Fist crashed when Cage was again framed, this time for the murder of Iron Fist. After he escaped and the charges were dropped, Cage disappeared. His closest friends weren't sure he was even alive. The paper has hired North to find Cage, and he has been traced to Chicago. Shouldn't be too hard to find him. All we got to do is look for trouble, and Cage will probably be up to his neck. At that moment, Cage is up to his neck in trouble, tossing guys around in Chicago. These are thugs who are roughing up strikers at a plant, and one of the thugs draws a gun on the bulletproof man. He is not slowed until a taserized chain wraps him up. The toughs flee in a truck, but Cage leaps to catch it, mouthing his free market philosophy. The guy with the electrified chains is called Hardcore, and does go toe-to-toe with Cage. Hardcore speaks in an island dialect of some kind, which I will most definitely not try to replicate. But our hero won't let the men escape, flinging a manhole cover at them as they attempt to flee. In the aftermath, Cage's old buddy Hogarth approaches him. We saw Hogarth at the start of the issue in the boardroom, and he is representing the paper, the Chicago Spectator. The paper offers to hire Cage as their resident superhero, with him getting to take down bad guys for money and the newspaper getting the story. It sounds potentially like a win-win scenario. Cage's first assignment is Elio Angelopoulos, a gun collector and businessman with recent connections to the Magia, after getting deep in gambling debt. You know he's a bad guy for two reasons. He's a businessman who collects guns. Angel, as he is known, was behind the strike-breaking violence that Cage faced earlier in the day. Along with Mickey Hamilton, Cage takes off in the paper's flying newsroom. Hamilton, a veteran photographer, flew choppers as a correspondent in Nam. Hamilton reveals that he knew Luke's parents, Leonard and Esther Lucas. Luke's reaction is cold. That life is over. You don't know me, Mickey. You better remember that. The chopper flies over Angel's airstrip, and they find that Hardcore is already there. He throws his chain in the air, and it wraps around the copter's blades. Cage grabs the pilot, and they take the express elevator straight down. On the ground, Hamilton expresses his gratitude to Cage by expressing his doubts that Cage can take down Hardcore. Man, he trashed you. You got nothing to prove. You don't need to. Luke disagrees. Yes. Yes, I do. I took this job and I've got to finish it. It's what I do. Cage takes the attack to Hardcore, and the villain tries to run him down in his Jeep while quoting Longfellow. But Cage just punches the Jeep. Yeah, that's right. He punched the Jeep that was running him down. But Hardcore's electrified chains find their way around Cage's neck again, and the diamond tip weaponry injures our hero. There's no such thing as invulnerability to modern technology, and Power Man's not so powerful against a weapon he can't touch. Don't call me that, he says in anger, flexing his way out of the chains. I'm Cage. While Cage takes on Hardcore, Hamilton, the photographer slash pilot, punches out the escaping Angelopolis, but his slumping body pushes the accelerator down, and the Jeep, loaded with weapons, just rolls on. Hardcore makes it to Angel's plane, but the battle has made the runway impassable. Nobody's flying anywhere, so Cage rips open the plane, and the fight continues. Cage noted that Hardcore always stays just out of his reach, avoiding fighting in close quarters. But that distance, the separation between the men, makes enough room for the runaway Jeep to get between the combatants and run into a nearby plane and explode with a very nice crackoom. The story has two one-page denouements. At the scene, as Angel is taken away by police, the Chicago Spectator's news editor chastises Cage for not avoiding the confrontation. You're lucky that the cops were more interested in Angel's connection to Hardcore than to yours to our paper. But Hamilton, the photographer slash pilot, steps in to defend Cage. We want your help. We want to set you up with advertising in the Chicago Spectator, nationwide, for your hero for hire gig. We'll even cover your expenses. In exchange, we get exclusive with my pictures of the cases you handle. Cage is reluctant, but the men shake hands. Now, about those expenses. We then move to St. Croix, where Hardcore has somehow managed to survive the explosion, make his way to the tropics, and report to his boss. They're both upset about Cage's involvement, as he was not to be their objective, quote, for some time, unquote. The boss, who I don't recognize, continues. That plan requires Cage to be humbled, broken to our purposes. This exercise has given him a handhold at rebuilding his life. He may even rise to threaten my larger plans, which must not happen.
I prowl the rooftops and alleyways at night, searching for justice, blind justice, a guardian devil.
No, that's not actually true. I'm not Daredevil, blind attorney by day and fearless crime fighter by night. No, I am J. David Weider, a podcaster, but you can call me Dave. I do read about Daredevil and his adventures, and I podcast about it on my show, Dave's Daredevil Podcast. You see, it's my Daredevil, you get it. Every Sunday, I read a Daredevil comic and share my thoughts and feelings on the issue, the characters, and the world of Marvel's Man Without Fear in an easily accessible audio form. And I want to take you along for the ride, so tune in each week as we meet Daredevil, his villains, his loves, and more hornhead goodness than you can shake a billy club at. That is every Sunday on iTunes and at www.daredevilpodcast.com. That is daredevilpodcast.com. Take the dare. Listen to Dave's Daredevil Podcast. Did I really just say take the dare?
And we're back. This is the second number one issue that I've covered on the show, the first being Nick Fury's Howling Commandos. And I have two more coming up, but to be fair, one of those issues is a one-shot, and one is a mini-series of which I'm going to cover all three issues. But still, it's something I want to keep an eye on and make sure that I'm covering issues on the podcast from later in books' runs. I mean, statistically speaking, there are many more comics with low numbers than high numbers, because you know, every title has had a number one, almost every title has had a number two, a few fewer have had number threes, and so on. And as fans of comics, we know that very few have hit 100 issues, and even fewer 200, and of course even fewer 300 or 400. And given the supply and demand nature of what ends up in the cheapy bins, I do think that low-numbered issues are probably overrepresented. Books that have been around long enough to get to an issue 300 or 400, I think the companies are a little better about judging the appropriate print run, and less likely to massively overpublish, say, issue 315 than issue 2. So there will be a tendency towards lower numbered issues, but it is something I'll try to keep an eye on. Anyway, to this issue. I tend to be a fan of Luke Cage. In my regular collection, I have the last 70 or 75 issues of the Hero for Hire title, that classic series with him and Iron Fist. We talked for a while with Luke Giaconetti about Luke Cage in episodes 10 and 11 of Shortbox Showcase, also available in this feed and website. And then a couple of other episodes of that show, Emily and I have talked about Cage in the context of the Ultimate Spider-Man cartoon. I like that this title is not a reboot, but picks up the Cage timeline 6 years after the end of the Heroes for Hire book. When you have an established character in a new number one, you never quite know which version of the character you'll get, which direction they're going to be going. But this iteration seemed to me to be fundamentally Luke Cage. The Hero for Hire shtick is alive and well, as he explains during his first encounter with the gang. "I'm hot with my fist, boyies, but I bust heads for the American dream. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of boku bucks." Yes, he actually said boyies. Those first two pages of the story in the boardroom set the stage well, and even though it was literally a person giving us exposition, McLaurin gave us a context that made sense, and so that didn't stand out in a negative way. And then on page 3, we have a full-page splash of Cage beating up four guys, so we get to the action pretty quick. Even though this is fundamentally the same Luke Cage, his look has been updated. No tiara, no gold shirt, unbuttoned to the waist. There is an unbuttoned shirt, but there is an undershirt as part of the look as well. So Cage has learned the fashion technique of layering. Cage is wearing a belt, and in some panels, its shape is reminiscent of the tiara. I ran by Emily these notions of mine on Cage's fashion, and she pointed out something I hadn't noticed. I mentioned that on the cover, Cage is snapping electrified chains, and all I thought of was Hardcore's weapon in the issue. But not having read the issue, she thought of it as symbolic of Cage breaking free of the chain belt that was another part of his 70s costume. How conscious that was, whether that image was created to have a double meaning, I don't know, but I thought that her take was interesting. You know, the character of Luke Cage has had a rough, rough life, and his attitude of only trusting himself makes a fair bit of sense. Getting framed once is bad enough for crying out loud, but getting framed twice? That counts as a rough, rough life. A big deal is made of his not shaking hands with the newspaper people at the start of the issue, so when he does so with the photographer slash pilot at the end of the issue, we have a nice parallel there, a nice sense of a growing trust with this Mickey Hamilton, who I think is a new character. I enjoyed the story overall. It took place over a single day and in only a few locations. That is what I want from a street-level book, the narrower focus of both time and place. But there was movement of physical locations around Chicago, as well as movement in the plot and in the characters. One criticism I have to bring up, and it relates to a comment that Chris Honeywell and Scott Gardner mentioned in a recent Star Wars Monthly Monday. In episode 58 of that show, in covering an issue of The Further Adventures of Indiana Jones, they discussed a scene in which Indy's bullwhip had grown to unbelievable proportions. Unbelievable as in not believable, not possible in any way. They'd noted before that the bullwhip grew and shrunk in size to fit the needs of the scene, but this one particular moment was just too much for both of them. Similarly, the scene where Hardcore uses his chain to pull down the helicopter is beyond belief. The length of chain that would be required to reach the chopper and wrap around the blades as many times as is shown in the art, I mean, that would be so much chain he would be tripping over it as he walked. or it would more likely be too heavy for even an enhanced human to carry. Now, it was a great moment, a great scene, a great visual, a great attack, but it strained credulity, as the saying goes. Then there is the fact that half the issue is just one fight scene. A pretty good fight scene, actually, but still, it's one scene that lasts 10 pages. But again, in a street-level book, the fighting itself is the main superpower on display, so that can work. I wouldn't want every issue to follow this template, but for this one issue, for a debut issue in particular, it works. The verdict on Cage number 1. Worth a quarter for sure. Not my favorite of the books I've covered in the Quarterbin podcast, but certainly worth the time I spent reading it, and well worth 25 cents. This did what a first issue was supposed to do, and what Nick Fury's Howling Commandos number 1 failed to do, at least for me, make me interested in reading more. If I see the next few issues of this run of Cage in the cheapy stacks, I won't hesitate to pick them up. I'm curious about where the story goes. I know the series only ran 20 issues, but that's enough to potentially tell some really excellent stories and have solid character development. So, no promises, but maybe we'll see old Luke Cage again. That wraps up my coverage of Cage number 1, bringing episode 13 of the Quarterbin podcast to a close. In episode 14, we'll take our first journey into the world of the Dark Knight Detective, beginning his 75th birthday year with Batman, the 10-Cent Adventure, cover dated March 2002. Wow, a book from this millennium. That's only the second time that's happened in this podcast. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or the podcast, feel free to contact me. Feedback for the show, or any show from the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts, can be sent to relativelygeeky@gmail.com. Images, show notes, and links for episodes can be found at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the Quarterbin. And I want to take this opportunity to wish you all holiday blessings, a joyous and happy new year, and of course, even though Luke Cage never said it once in the entire issue, we at the Relatively Geeky family wish all our listeners and their families a sweet Christmas.
Jerusalem and the holy temple filled with smoke. Zachariah shuns the news from the angel of hope. Stuck behind an incense cloud of religion and disappointment, God keeps slipping out of underneath rocks, in alleys off the beaten path. Open both your eyes. Prophets and kings and poets can contribute their work. Just like eggs in a nest are alive with the promise of birds. But the Lord of creation will not be subjected to expectation. God keeps slipping out of underneath rocks, in alleys off the beaten path. Open both your eyes. Consistent prayers flow to the sky and revive her soul. God, we will wait, though we don't understand your redemptive story. God keeps slipping out of underneath rocks and alleys off the beaten path. Open both.